It's not a zoo where you look in and it's the same right. setting.
It's not.
It changes.
Zoo. I love it.
Hello, construction industry professionals. You're listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. Here are your hosts, Devin and Kevin.
Today, we're going to dive in and have a fireside chat with Neil Evers, licensed AIA architect that works for HMH Architecture Plus Interiors, a great architect firm that we do a lot of local business with out of Boulder, Colorado, that is very cutting edge and such a great firm. He's also an instructor at CU Boulder. So I think it'll be really fun to talk about him as going to college, getting his master's, and then going into the field, working for a big firm, SOM, with a medium firm, Roth Shepherd, to then now a boutique, a small firm with HMH, to hear how he's worked for firms, how he went to school, got his master's, and he still is a professor at CU Boulder. So a lot of great information to peel back the layers and talk architecture with Neil Evers.
Well, and they're very passionate about the work they do, and they do such great work. It's going to be exciting to hear the details about how they put it all together and take care of their clients and come up with these great concepts.
So let's dive in and ask Neil what his favorite beverage is. So what's your favorite beverage?
Favorite beverage, coffee. I love coffee. You know, favorite might not even be a fair word for it because I think I need it.
put a few hours in the behind the desk in the architecture field, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Maybe favorite beverage that I don't need is beer. I like beer.
Heck yeah. I'm a fan of that as well. What's your favorite beer brand in Boulder? You guys have a bunch of really good ones. Which one are your favorite
breweries? We do have some good ones. Right now, I'm really enjoying Upslope Brewery. I think they're just really cool people all around. I have some friends who have a few events in the area, and they always sponsor. They always give us beer when it's a good cause so they can help us get people in the door, because free alcohol gets people in the door.
Absolutely. It has a way of doing it.
Absolutely. I live close by to their Lee Hill Brewery, and so I go there quite a bit, and yeah, I just get a really good vibe from them, and I think their beer is delicious too, but there's no shortage of delicious beer in Boulder, that's for sure.
That's great.
There you go. What's your favorite place you've traveled?
You know, I've traveled a bunch. I've been really blessed in my life. I've been able to go a lot of places, but I think my favorite place that I've been is probably Japan. When I was in college, I got to go to Japan. It was part of an enrichment program through the College of Engineering. And instead of a scholarship with some cash, it was just kind of like a scholarship as an enrichment program. And so they took some engineering students, and architecture was in engineering college. And so I got to go there. And that same semester I got to go there, I was also in a Japanese architecture course, which was taught by one of the emeritus faculty at Oklahoma State. And I learned all about Japanese architecture and the tradition of it and where it was going in modern times, and just got all this rich information about it. And then, totally unplanned but really lucky, I got to go to Japan for a couple of weeks, which who gets to do that when they're in their 20s?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so anyway, those two things synthesized, and I think as a result, that's probably my favorite place I've been.
Give us one experience or story from that trip.
The one thing I remember the most or most vividly is these temples that we learned about in my class. There were these very lush, very old, ancient wood structures. You know, we talked a lot about joinery. They're really beautiful buildings. And they're literally from a different era. They were built long, long time ago. And I guess in my mind, I just imagined that if you were to go to one of these, you would climb a mountain and hike through miles of dense forest. And maybe there were roads, maybe not. I don't know. But when I got to Tokyo itself, and we went to some of these temples, they're right in the middle of the city. And it was just a stark contrast between the huge, glassy, steel, concrete city into these very serene temples. And I remember that contrast being one of the most interesting parts. I was just completely surprised. I didn't expect that.
Well, what an awesome Absolutely. College experience to like learn it and live it and then bring it all full circle. Yeah, and that's absolutely. Really what we're trying to do on The Art of Construction, is really talk about real world opportunities and peel back those layers instead of just talking theories, which there's a lot of that, you know, and that's good. You need to learn that. But there's sure. also the real world to bring it all together. And that's what has been so fun to talk about. Tell us about your favorite hobby or interest outside of practicing architecture.
Most of the time I spend outside of architecture, which is probably about half my time, is on a bicycle. I love cycling. You could probably stop a stranger on the street in Denver and ask them what their favorite thing to do is, and you would get hiking or biking or something along those lines, yeah, camping. Yeah, yeah. So it's not that unique, but I truly love it. And I bike 2,000 or 3,000 miles a year, and it's a good exercise, and it's good to take care of myself. But I also spend a lot of time thinking about work when I'm out there too, and I think a healthy way, you know, even though I'm not at work.
Excellent. So we have Neil Evers into Studio MVWD today, who is a licensed AIA architect with HMH Architecture Plus Interiors, who the principals there are Harvey and Sherry. Tell us about what it's like working at HMH and what separates you from a very cutting-edge group of architects out of Boulder, Colorado.
Sure. Well, what it's like working there, first off, it's a great environment. It's like a family, really, and I know that's kind of a cliche thing to say, but it really truly is. We have two dogs and seven human beings right now in a small office. It's probably about 500 square feet. So we're all tight. Harvey and Sherry are, I think, excellent people to work for. They give me a lot of leeway to design, and they appreciate my design. Even though I have less experience than them, they see something in me that they want to value, and they let me express myself, which I think is pretty rare. I think it's hard as an architect. You guys work with architects. You know, we have a tendency to be a little bit of control freaks, right? Maybe a little bit, maybe. But Harvey and Sherry both let me really run with a lot of projects and make mistakes, which I think is rare too. And they've been really cool about it. And as far as our office and how we operate in Boulder, we just spend a lot of time thinking about our value proposition. You know, what differentiates us from the others in Boulder that we consider our competition? We've got Arc 11 and Studio B moved out of Aspen recently and opened a Boulder office. And Surround is doing really cool things in the last few years. And there are others. So we're constantly reevaluating our position in the market. And we have clients come in our door that's like, why should we hire you instead of Arc 11? They'll just ask us that. And so we have to come up with a reason. And I think one of the things that we do better than anyone else is we do the capital M modern architecture. Harvey was kind of a student of Corbusier, not literally a student of Corbusier, but he studied his work and was really inspired by it. And that kind of trickles down through our office and how we all design. And I think it comes out in our work. We do a lot of modern that is hits on certain trends. We do a lot of modern that is warm, but we also do modern that is very traditional in what capital M modern style is and its principles. And I think we're proud of that.
Excellent. So tell us a few things that you think really separates good modern architecture, as modern is so hot right now, but you hear contemporary this and, you know, clean lines that. What do you think really separates, you know, and really makes a good modern design pop? And talk through some of those things as contractors and architects listening to this, because we're always talking about the homeowner really understanding what they truly want and an architect speccing that to a builder to actually build that. Because sometimes you could put on paper and the builder can skew that, or the homeowner is thinking something different. When you say modern, maybe I just say it's about being as simple as clean and you see nothing and that's is what we want. Well, obviously there's a lot more to it, but how do you make it so clean and simple and modern and work?
Oh, that's a good question. That's a really difficult question too, because like you said, there's lots of opinions, and where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, it doesn't always make sense. And I think where we start is we describe to our clients that modern is lack of decoration, right? Details are very simple and it's not easy to do. It looks easy and it's actually really difficult. And that's really important when we talk to prospective clients, because we want them to understand that just because it looks simple, it's not easy to do. And that's why it takes so long and that's why it costs so much, basically. But for instance, the analogy or the example we like to use is in a traditional home, you can do a punched window. And if I design that punched window incorrectly by 3/4 of an inch, probably no one will ever know, because it's just floating in the wall. It doesn't necessarily line up with anything. Even if the opening was a little too big, you cover it up with some trim. There's lots of ways to cover up your mistakes. And don't even need to say cover up mistakes. There's a lot of ways to build a little loosely that you don't have to do.
Definitely, yeah.
And in modern, this is an example that's actually real. There was one time where I did design a window 3/4 of an inch too tall, and it had to be thrown out and reordered. So
it happens.
It happens. And so the amount of detail and attention we have to give to that detail is immensely intense compared to, I think, other styles of architecture.
And I think that's so important, that what you just said right there, is because when we say spec to secure the vision, a firm like HMH is so great to work for in our day-to-day, because you guys take the time to detail out exactly where that window sitting on countertops or details like that. There's not a lot of fudge factor into that.
No, not at all.
And that's where a builder is used to working in rough openings to have the fudge factor. It's more costly to work in exact versus rough openings.
It is.
You know? And that's the part I tell people, it costs more to look so perfect and streamlined.
It really does. Yeah. I mean, one real practical way of addressing that concern or that risk is we always encourage clients and builders to carry a contingency, meaning it's an amount of money that's sitting there, not specified towards any one thing, one item, one process, but it's sitting there because there will be mistakes made. And I've talked about this with a lot of my friends and family, and there's only one person that's ever really understood what I was trying to describe, and he was a laser scientist or laser physicist at Lockheed Martin, and he makes custom lasers. And he's like, oh, yeah, I could never make a one-off custom laser without some mistake being made or some oversight or something that had to be figured out while it was being built. And I was like, oh, you get it. Because it is hard to figure out.
Yeah, because I think oftentimes the thought process with the average person is that that contingency is like a slush fund. It's really not. It's really designed for those things that you cannot anticipate until you're in the middle of it, and then you've got to deal with it. You got to fix it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's even hard not to talk about it in a negative light too, because it's not a negative thing. It just is.
Yep.
When you do something this custom, this exact, this precise, with this little amount of decoration and simple details, there just will be things that you cannot figure out until it's being built in the field.
Well, I think what you described earlier with a window being off by as little as 3/4 of an inch, you had to throw it out and start over. That's a perfect example, because that's what the tolerances are. In many cases, even less than that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I want to go back to the beginning with Neil, as far as you've had some experiences going to school, Bachelor of Architecture at Oklahoma State, and then Master in Business Administrative at University of Colorado Boulder. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your experiences with going to college. So maybe some younger architects, or maybe people on the other end looking to kind of start back over. What are some of the really theories and principles you gathered out of all those years of schooling?
It's a great question, and it's hard to answer too, because I think school has a tendency to fall short, and not because anyone's doing anything wrong. I just think it's really difficult to work within the building industry and then to also learn about design before you enter the building industry. There's just inherently a disconnect there. So I think a lot of what school is about is learning the theories behind architecture and design, learning some of the skills that you'll use when you're in the workforce, so like computer programs, how to draw, how to communicate. In fact, I would almost say how to communicate is the most important thing you learn in school.
Bingo. Yep.
Yeah. And then really, you don't get a chance to learn how to communicate on the job very well as a professional, at least not in my experience. So a lot of those skills were expected of me before I entered the field. So I really do think school is really kind of like professional prep. And then I had a colleague at SOM in Chicago who said that my first few years at SOM would be like finishing school. And I think that's accurate.
Yeah, and it's accomplishing and learn how to accomplish something, and people that are sending you good information along the way.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's probably hard, a little bit harder for you to answer that question, because now you're instructor at CU Boulder, right?
That's correct.
So I really find that intriguing and really impressed when I meet people that are giving back. Like, hopefully people are getting something good out of the art of construction, that we take our time to turn the microphone on and talk about that. But for you to go and tell us what you instruct and kind of some of your big messages you tell students in the field of architecture.
Sure, yeah. And depending on how good I sound on this, I might have them listen to it. What I try to tell my students, and I want to be clear about CU Boulder, it's an environmental design program, so they're learning about landscape architecture, planning, and architecture all at the same time. Urban design is in the mix too. And then in their third year, they're encouraged to pick an emphasis, and then they get a major in that emphasis. So we do have architecture majors as the output of the program. So sometimes when they're in my studio, and I teach them at their senior year at the moment, this is the last chance they have to really cram all they can learn about architecture in before they go to grad school or before they put their hat in the ring for employment. So I try to get them skills. I try to help them build a portfolio of skills that can show an employer that they should hire them, and they could be a benefit to that firm. Now, in the process, I want to teach them about theory of architecture. So I want to teach them rules of thumb. I want to teach them a lot about misconceptions that they have about the industry, and there are a lot of them. I think a lot of students, they come in and they think that an architect does everything. And depending on the firm that they're at, an architect actually does very little other than make a schematic for everyone else to work off of. So, you know, on our website, we were talking about this flow chart of schematic design, and a really big commercial firm will design something through schematics, and then there are pieces of that project that we pass off to other consultants who need to do the real work on it. So, for instance, most architects don't do structural design. There's always a structural engineer. Most architects also will not do landscape design, especially on a big project, or civil engineering work, which is a lot like landscape design if you don't know what civil engineering is. A lot of what I try to teach my students is that your job as an architect is not to do everything. It's just to know a little bit about everything so that you can get all these people to talk to each other efficiently, because that's really your job as a project manager at some point. And to also get them to understand it's okay not to know everything. It's okay to ask questions, and it's okay to say, I don't know.
Definitely.
Well, and you touched on the fact that in your own experience, communication is the thing that you fall back on, that kind of one of your more important areas of focus. And that's something that we hear a lot with our guests on the show, is that whether it be a contractor that's been interacting with architects or vice versa, that whole communication aspect is kind of the common denominator about whether a project becomes successful or not.
Yeah, absolutely. It's really all about communication. And communication is not just saying what you know, it's saying what might happen, and sometimes those are awkward things to talk about, right?
Absolutely.
Like, hey, it looks like the schedule may not come down to where we want it to in a couple months, and you can't be sure of that when you're saying it, and someone might not want to hear it. But at the same time, if everyone zips their mouth and doesn't say anything, and then 2 months happens, and there's a lot of really hurt feelings and money loss, and it can be a big problem. So communication is also anticipating what could go wrong or could go well and how to get on top of it. And it's a tricky game. It really is. But I think the better communication skills we give them in school, the better students are when they start their profession. And our employers that hire our students really like that.
Yeah, and you referenced the design phases on HMH website, which we'll make sure we put on the show notes. And I look at this, I bet a lot of students will probably look at this and say, it's really this fragmentic. It's not lineal, you know, like you just teach it and you go out and do it.
Right.
In the real world, it's not. And what we do, it's a windy road to where we all are talking through that. And we talk about that on every show. So if you're, you know, one of Neil's students listening to this for the first time, this is a real world to hear, you know, peel back some more layers. And the whole idea is you don't have enough time to make all the mistakes yourself. So we try to turn the microphone on and put our heads together and collaborate to say, hey, learn from other people's mistakes to excel. And that's what something Neil has done such a great job with Sherry and Harvey and everyone on the team. You know, they are very upfront with education. Harvey went back to us with the Anderson trip this year, CAD details, the schooling. Tell me about Colorado Homes and Lifestyles. You were just given the 5 Under 40 award, which is really cool to say, okay, you're pushing and doing all this hard work. It's nice to get a pat on the back. So pat on the back with a congratulations on winning that,
right,
and tell us what that's all about.
Sure. Yeah, Colorado Homes and Lifestyles, one of the few magazines in the Denver area. I like to call it the Denver region because we really kind of include areas of New Mexico and Kansas and Wyoming a little bit too. But they're one of the few magazines that talks about the building industry and the residential construction industry. And we really value their opinions. Not all the styles they represent are modern. So we don't always agree on how things are communicated in that sense. But to get an award and some recognition from that magazine especially, it was really an honor. We like to keep our minds loose and fresh, and we like to kind of bend around what the trends are and understand them. And sometimes, even like I said, we don't agree with the styles. We need to know what's going on. And so we really, really need Colorado Homes and Lifestyles. We need other magazines like Modern in Denver and even the national magazines like The Well. We need them to kind of help educate us, because otherwise, finding that information on our own is really difficult to do. So we look for a few resources that way. I mean, your guys' podcast is another example of a good resource for what's happening in the construction industry. So I think we're all helping each other out.
I have to read the quote that Colorado Homes and Lifestyles put in there, and we'll put a link in the show notes to go check out his answers, and maybe we can peel back a few of these layers from that. That magazines do a great job of hitting the bullet points, but sometimes there's a little bit more to the story that we can talk to on The Art of Construction. But the quote that you put in there, I really liked. It says, I really liked Legos as a kid. When I was 5 or 6, someone told me I should become an architect, and it just stuck. I had no choice from that point forward.
It's true. Be so careful what you tell your children.
Architecture is like one of those fields that I think there's a lot of people that from 5 or 6, the Legos, and they love the building and they love to travel and see stuff. So they say, I want to put all that together. But then you can hit the real world and it can be kind of scary, or you can go into a firm. Were you with any other firms before HMH?
Yeah, actually. My first job was with Skidmore, Owings & Merrill in Chicago, and that was right out of college. And then I moved to Denver about 10 years ago, and since then I've split about half the time with Harvey and Sherry presently, and then with Ross Shepherd Architects in Denver before that.
Right.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
So you worked with a really big firm in Chicago.
Yeah.
Ross Shepard, who's kind of in between, and now Harvey Hein, which is a real boutique family architect firm. Tell us, you know, without good or bad, but just saying the differences of working from a big firm to a small firm as you being an instructor, as well as now you've spent some years in the field for listeners to digest.
Sure. I actually talk to my students about it quite a bit because they're curious. And there are differences between big firms and small firms, and none of them are better than the other. In some ways, they can be. Like, big firms have a lot of resources. So we had an in-house print shop at Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and we had the equivalent of a laser printer that printed 30 by 40 inch sheets, which is rare. So we could get a drawing set done in a few seconds instead of right now at Harvey's office. Since we can't afford those kinds of resources, we outsource it and we send it to the printers and wait for it to come like everyone else, right?
Or use the computer screen.
Or just,
I mean, we're to the point at Mountain View where it's a challenge for all of us, especially the people that have been writing and doing, to switch to do a digital takeoff. As a small firm, you got to be creative to be able to go against the behemoth, but you have the plus and minuses of both.
Right? Yeah, and in fact, actually, permitting offices are starting to allow us to turn in digital drawings too, but they're probably the least incentivized to change and progress, so it's a slow process. I got my license recently and took my exams, and I think it's been a couple of years now, but when I was doing that process, I was really thankful for having exposure to the huge projects of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, and the medium projects of Ross Shepard, and the small residential projects of HMH. They're all different construction types, right? Like HMH, we do type 5 construction. It's all sticks and it's all wood, and it's different kinds of building systems and different kinds of structural details. And the same thing on the other end of the spectrum, it's just lots of steel and concrete. So when I took those exams, I had an exposure to every part of that exam prior to studying for it, where some of my peers had to spend time learning about big building systems that they'd never been exposed to. And my students are curious about that stuff too, right? They want to know what it's like to be in a big firm. They want to know what it's like to be in a little firm. And so, yeah, I'm just happy that I can share that with them, really. I didn't plan it that way. It just sort of panned out. I will say I do like the small projects a lot better. They're easier. And that can be more fun when things are easy. Sometimes you can have more fun. I tried to explain to some people about the difference in this way, where when I worked at a big firm, I spent about, I'd say I spent about 30% of my time designing and 70% of my time doing project management. And now with the smaller projects, I'm spending about the opposite, about 70% of my time designing and 30% doing project management. So that's another difference between big and small firms that I think is important.
Hello.
Hi, I've been listening to The Art of Construction, and I noticed you guys have no sponsors. Why is that?
Well, thanks for the call. We do actually have a sponsor. It's Mountain View Window and Doors, our sole sponsor to run this great podcast. But we're always looking for quality companies that might have an interest in our audience of great architects and contractors.
So how could I become a sponsor for you?
Well, that's simple. This is Devin Tilley here. And the background of this is we are very specific about creating this show that we don't want it to be a whole bunch of me, blah, 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 wah, 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 wah. This is all about you contractors and architects growing your business. And we're not going to fake it till we make it. This wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Mountain View Window and Door. The studio is in the best showroom in the nation, awarded by Anderson Windows and Doors out of Denver, Colorado. But The Art of Construction is its own standalone platform that is now on its own website, www.theartofconstruction.net. And we are looking for the best advertiser, and we're not going to just settle for anybody. This is like Mountain View Window and Door, only the best that makes sense. And if you want to be part of that, reach out to us on theartofconstruction.net on the message board, and we'll run it through to the department and see if it's a good fit. So we look forward to talking to you, but we're going to guarantee you, contractors and architects, this is not an advertisement or a plug. This is all about you to grow your business.
Tell us a little bit about your influences in architecture. You know, was there a specific architect out there that you gravitated to, and kind of how that did influence your career?
Sure. Tadao Ando is one of my favorites. He's a Japanese architect. Did some really amazing stuff with concrete, stuff that we can't even do in the U.S. because we don't have, I shouldn't say we don't have. We use concrete differently. We use it quickly. We use it underground a lot of the times, and it does a very blunt job a lot of the times in the way we design our buildings in the U.S. And in other places, Japan's one of those places, architecture is just treated as a different material. It's treated as has the potential to be a fine finished material. But I loved his work, and I loved how he used light. And I think it was one of the first kind of aha moments as a student where I was like, oh, this is different than other things I've seen. And I started to kind of pay attention to what light does in space and use that for my own thinking about architecture. I mean, it's been years past that point before I really felt like I actually had any traction with any of those ideals. And I feel like now I'm starting to actually have learned enough about technology and enough about building systems that I can start to do some of those things that are a little bit more advanced in design. But I still have that Tadao Ando design kind of been with me for the whole time, which has been very nice.
Cool. The podcast you're listening to is titled The Art of Construction. I think it really is tied into a lot of the arts field that is a lot of it tied into architecture. Quote on your HMH website about the Get to Know Us page is by Steve Martin that says, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. And I think that's such a cool quote from researching and learning about Neil. I think you have a lot of inspiration between music and architecture. So talk about how you kind of blend that stuff together to make you smile and have the inspiration come through the project.
Oh, sure. Well, I have like a directly relatable relationships between music and architecture, and that when I'm just having a crap day and I can't seem to design my way out of a box, I can grab my guitar and play or listen to music and it gets me out of myself a little bit. And that's really strong. And then I use it as an analogy all the time with my students. And I tell them if they've played music, they get it. But even if they haven't, I still think they get it, is that if you're playing a really delicate, slow song with very few phrases, very few instruments, any mistake you made is amplified. And so it's actually really hard to play something slow and to play something powerful and very stripped away. And then the same thing is true, or the opposite is true, with fast music. The more voices you have and the faster it's going and the more flourishes and movement and ups and downs and volume changes, the more things can be hidden, the more mistakes can be under layers of different textures of music and phrases. Architecture is the same way. If you're Tadao Ando and you have the really simple structure with one slit in the building and lights coming through, it's so hard to get everything right. It's all about proportion, and just every little tiny move has to be scrutinized. And sometimes changing one thing will change six other things without intending it to happen that way. And then a very busy design, which I don't think is necessarily worse, and I hope I'm not giving off that vibe, but a very busy design, like someone like Frank Gehry or Daniel Libeskind, you know, the Denver Art Museum here, all these forms come crashing together, and there's drama, and there's loud kind of clashes of design, and you can hide some of those details, or maybe they're not even important. Maybe it's not about hiding them. But I do think there's kind of an analogy between music and architecture that I like to try to teach.
I love that analogy. In high school, I tried to play the guitar, and I had too many other irons in the fire, and I did it for lessons for a couple months, and now I want to pick it up again. So I bought myself a guitar, and I'm like, I'm just going to go to YouTube, and I get to myself where I'm like trying to pick it and play it to where it's perfect, and then I just get kind of frustrated, and I just start ripping chords out and just kind of let it out sometimes. And I think that's a fair how it both is. You can throw together a project, and you see these a lot right now where there's all these, just throw some colors and a bunch of vinyl windows and just throw it out there and call it modern.
Sure.
Well, or you see a design from HMH that everything is precision, and a lot of people don't quite, they don't know what the difference is, but they know it's not right. And I think that's a great analogy to put that together.
Sure. So, well, and you know, also just to add to that, like Ando couldn't design a Gehry building if his life depended on it, and Gehry probably couldn't design an Ando building if his life depended on it. And there's places for both too. I think it's important.
You know, that brings up something I'm curious about, and that is one of the things that we always think about when it comes to building and architecture, all the practical aspects. Talk a little bit about, because since you kind of hit on the emotive kinds of things, how do you communicate that with a client to get into kind of what they're looking for with that home that you're building and designing in terms of how they want to feel and that kind of thing? Talk a little bit about how you work through those details to communicate that and kind of get the feedback from the customer to make sure that you're providing the kinds of things that they're really looking for.
Yeah, definitely. There are a couple of ways to approach that question. And one, which I think comes up more often than not with clients because they understand it, is this idea of theater. And there's feeling in theater, right? You kind of set up the story with the first few acts of the play, and then there's climax in the middle, and then there's some kind of after effects or things that kind of wrap it all together. And I think architecture can be really similar. It's not always as linear as theater. For instance, when you enter a building, and Frank Lloyd Wright was kind of the master at this, he would kind of scrunch you down in a small space. His were almost painfully small. Like sometimes if you a tall person, which you guys, you guys might have hit your head touring some of his buildings.
Yeah, we
do. Literally, you do.
Tell the story about multiple people. Like We do a yearly trip back to Taliesin. We take architects, and hopefully you can go on that trip.
Yeah,
with us
this
next
is Wisconsin.
Year. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
We do that trip, and it is painfully. It's very. But once you learn about it, you appreciate it. So this is perfect. So listen to this story, and then go to our website. Any architects that want to get on these trips, we pay for the whole deal. It's a phenomenal experience, but it's to the point where it's awkward small.
Yeah. Like, it's beyond kind of the message. You literally hit your head in many cases if you're 6 feet tall. So,
well, if you learn anything about Frank Lloyd Wright, you know that he really cared a lot about Frank Lloyd Wright. He was very interested in Frank Lloyd Wright.
Yeah.
So his, I forget the quote. I wish I could remember because it'd be so much better. But he basically said, "Who cares about tall people?" Because he himself was not tall.
Yeah, they say that in the tour. They point that out.
And I was actually at Taliesin and outside of Phoenix recently.
Yep, I've been to that one too.
And it was great. But Frank Lloyd Wright was kind of the master at this thing where he scrunched people down at the beginning. And this isn't out of his mouth. It's just sort of my interpretation of what I think he was trying to do. But then as soon as you exit that entrance space, an entrance space is not necessarily meant to hang around in. It's kind of meant to transition you.
Right.
So there's an emotive response to being scrunched. And then it opens up, and then there's light, and that light is purposeful, and those views are capturing something for the most part. And there's an opening or an exhale of the space, and you're in something bigger where you're meant to spend time, and you're more comfortable. And I think when we get to what clients want about their home, sometimes we try to teach them that not every space has to be fantastic. Not every space has to be powerful, if you will, or meaningful. So we try to get them to spend more of their efforts, more of their thinking or money, if that's the case, on the spaces like their living room or their powder room or spaces where people are meant to to spend time when they visit the home. And so we do talk about theater. We talk about squeezing people through the entry. Like maybe don't spend a lot of time there. You know, maybe you don't need that really expensive bench feature that you saw in House. Maybe we can focus that on something else, you know. And then this connection to the indoor-outdoor space in Colorado, which exists in other places in the country, but we just have such lucky, dry, temperate weather here that we really try to open up outdoor, indoor space, and we try to save them money on not spending a lot on their living room because you can have a living room that opens up to the outdoors without really a lot of problems like bugs and things that people in other parts of the country deal with. And you know, there's also a different emotion between being inside and being outside and what it means to be transitioning between those two and what it means to invite one into the other at certain times of the year and how that can transform your space and how you feel about it. And so a house doesn't have to be a dynamic terrarium kind of museum experience. You know, it's not a zoo where you look in and it's the same
right.
setting.
It's not.
It changes.
I love it.
And architecture can allow it to do that.
One of the reasons I asked that is because somebody pointed that out to me a long time ago is when you go into a space and it could be colors, it could be how the room feels. And I never really thought about it, but it really is true is when you look at it, when you start thinking about it, if you're in a bright room, bright yellow room, maybe you're not comfortable. Whereas if the colors are more subdued, you feel more comfortable. And that goes to all the things you talk about, bringing the outdoors in and that kind of thing. So I just find it interesting when we think so much about practical things that's kind of the baseline in a way for getting started.
Yeah, it is. And it's either fun or frustrating. I'm not sure. But the aspect about it is that it's so subjective. And one person's opinion on yellow being comfortable or
right.
uncomfortable.
Absolutely.
And you've got to suss that out of the client, and you've got to help them become confident in knowing something that they maybe hadn't really thought about before. And so it's a really interesting process.
So what's a question you ask a potential client to get that out of them, other than just saying, give me your house idea book, which we go through that every show, but there's more to it than just give me pictures.
It's true. There is. Sometimes we just don't know until we're in the space. It's actually one of the reasons that we encourage clients to do a lot of painted surfaces, where right now there are a lot of trends of doing textured surfaces that are permanent, like reclaimed barnwood or some sort of funky tile or 3D printed CNC routed headboards and wood shapes. And if we really stick to some basic forms that aren't, I don't want to disqualify the other ones by calling them cheap tricks, but if you stay away from the tricks and you just stick to the volumes, then you can paint them any color you want and you can change your mind. So we do tell clients it's only paint. And so when we're speccing colors and they get scared and they want to make everything beige or a different shade of gray, sometimes that's us actually, but we can always say, if you change your mind, we can paint it a different color. It's okay. And I think that's really calming. And there's actually some truth in that. It's not just a cop-out. Like there is something to be said about focusing on the volume and mood and openings in the space and not necessarily the texture that you're applying to it after it's been
built. If you pick a whole room of pink marble, you're stuck with it, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's not really answering your question of how we suss it out of the clients. Yeah. A lot of it too is just building relationships and getting to know them.
And you guys do a really good job with 3D modeling and painting the picture on the, of the art of the construction before it's actually built as well, right?
We do. Yeah, we do. And it's amazing how many, I don't know if all of our clients have learned to demand that yet, but they should, because everyone can do it. And if an architect isn't using software that allows them to easily 3D render the space, and by render, I mean not necessarily photorealistic, but just 3D rendered, allow them to walk through it and feel the volumes, then I think that architect is behind. And I say that with confidence.
There you go. So let's peel back some layers on specific projects, maybe some that we have worked on you collectively, but tell us your most unique project that you've done recently in the market.
Sure. A really unique one is one that we are working on with you guys, where we did a lot of Anderson windows. We'd use a clear anodized metal clad window in Greenwood Village. And the gist of this project was the clients moved here at a really great time and got a fantastic property in Greenwood Village. It's like a horse property. So it's 5 acres. In Greenwood Village, that's pretty rare to find something that big, and they got a great price. But anyway, they had an existing house on the property that's very traditional, and it had been expanded on, and yeah, just a very traditional, kind of not really fitting within their style and what they think of themselves and their artistic style and their preferences. But it was a great property and they bought it. And then their plan was to do something with it eventually. They didn't really know what yet. So we helped them move in. And then through the exploration of that project and what they needed, they found out they needed a guest house to house their in-laws and guests. But in Greenwood Village, you can't really do a guest house because of the zoning laws. So you could, you just couldn't go more than one story. And even then it's kind of low flung because they want to keep things barn looking that aren't primary residences. And this is just a long way of saying we decided to do an addition to the house. And so we did a really modern addition onto a very traditional house. And we used this glassy bridge piece to connect the two. We worked with a landscape architect called Design Workshop out of Denver. For reasons that are complicated to explain, Dig is now taken over the project and finished it. But both those landscape architects together really came up with this great idea to funnel this 5-acre property through this bridge element, almost like an hourglass, and then funnel it back out again. And so there's a lot of drama in approaching the site. And it's just this really glassy, modern addition onto a traditional house. And we try to keep some of the roof forms the same so they speak to each other. And some of the colors and some of the textures are similar, but it's really A and B. They're different. And it's a funky project. And maybe it'll grow to combine the two aesthetically a little bit more, but I think it's kind of fun having them different. So we'll see what the client does.
That's cool. Yeah. We've been talking a lot about, you know, you can easily change paint, but we've talked a lot about the indoor-outdoor living spaces and creating that modern style, or like you just talked about, blending styles. Mm-hmm. There's things that are low cost and there's things that are they're high cost and really high cost to change down the road. And I would call those as the windows and doors that you're seeing through these views. So tell us your take on how you see from the architecture field, how and when you talk about windows and doors.
Oh, well, we talk about it right away. It's impossible to do schematic design without talking about openings. We don't like to think of them as openings per se. We talk about them right away. And our houses generally have a lot of glass, a result of our design process and beliefs, but also our clients who buy these amazing sites with amazing views, and we feel like we have an obligation to capitalize on those. So we really get into it early. I have 3 houses under construction at the moment, and 2 of the 3, the main driving concept for the house were the views of mountains or a lake or mountains over a lake. So we got into openings right away and started talking about windows because it's a budget driver. It's a big piece of their budget when their house has so much glass. And so we really do, I would say in the first 6 months, we start talking about manufacturers of windows and what type of window and what their expectations are around that.
So you've worked with a lot of different ones. Tell us some of the manufacturers that you tend to talk about and what those manufacturers do to achieve that modern design.
Sure. Yeah. Some of them you guys are familiar with and some of them you're maybe less familiar with. We kind of look at it as there are really 2, sometimes 3, depending on what the style of the house is. But there's usually 2 types of windows and doors that we start with. There's aluminum, so your Fleetwoods and your Raniers. And there's also wood windows or metal clad wood windows, and as is the case in Colorado. Usually that's a budgetary thing. If the house has a very strong connection to the indoor and outdoor, and we need these openings to be movable and operable, we really do look at aluminum systems first. We really like the way they look aesthetically, and it seems like sometimes we can get them to be smaller. And so we sometimes start with those right away. If the house has a little bit more of a modest approach to the indoor-outdoor connection, then sometimes we'll start with the aluminum-clad wood window because they're really good and they've been around forever, and there's no guesswork there, and they're priced really well. Does that answer your question?
I love that's a great analogy.
Okay, yeah, I think that's kind of a simple answer to the approach.
So tell us about what you think is some of the most important things of architecture, from being a student of architecture to a teacher of architecture to living the real world. So contractors and architects listening to this, tell us some things that you think are just the most important things to slow down and smell the roses.
Anything in the building that you're actually going to see and especially touch or interact with should be strongly considered. And sometimes those are the things that we consider at the end and we cut out of our budgets, which is very sad. We spend a lot of time at the beginning of projects talking about foundation and talking about structure that is oftentimes hidden from view and how to achieve those things. Sadly, we end up at the end of the project sometimes and we might cut something down in budget to have a less dramatic or a less highly sophisticated design for a window or a door, or even the levers of the doors that you use, or the kitchen appliances and the hardware on the cabinets. And those are sometimes left towards the end where there's not a lot of energy to consider them. But I really do think they should be considered because they're the most important things. Like you don't touch a lot of a building, really. You touch knobs and you touch door handles and you touch sinks and faucets and shower heads and stuff like that. That stuff really needs to be considered. And it should all be part of the same family. I think sometimes we tend to look at different rooms and we segment them into like different styles based on the room. But I really think it says something about the house when they all kind of speak the same language. And sometimes that can be boring for a client, so it's a tough sell. Because they're like, oh, I want to have this really cool faucet and this cool faucet.
So from the teacher perspective as well as the principal perspective, how do you talk to clients about that to begin with the end in mind? That we're always talking about getting it all right on paper and understanding the value and building that up to say, how do you get to the end? And what happens is that things happen at the beginning and then the budget dollars get pulled from here and say we can work. But how do you talk about that on both the theory and the principle that you wear both hats?
Sure. You know, it's not so much of a problem with budgets. It's more of a problem with expectations. And so a lot of times what we try to do is remind our clients that, yes, we did just get a permit to build. And yes, we did just demo the house. It used to be on your site or whatever the case. And it's not almost over. Like, we still have a lot of work to do.
A lot of chapters, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And I think sometimes it's they have this feeling or idea that once we're done designing the building and then we have permission to build it and it starts to be built, it's basically done. And that's not really the case because a lot of those decisions that I was talking about what parts of the building you design and spec and detail, those are really things that happen after the house is under construction. And students don't understand that either. They think that a schematic design for a building that you would do in an architecture studio, which takes 4 or 5 weeks for a building, they kind of feel like that's the end of it. I try to remind them or at least educate them to the fact that, no, everything has to be thought about. So when your concrete wall you just designed meets this wooden feature that you have sitting next to it, someone has to think about how those two materials meet. Like, someone will spend hours doing that and it's down the road, but it's hard for them to have that kind of perspective. But I try to just remind them that it's not over yet. Sometimes it's a little hard for them to care because in their life, that project's over because it's never going to be built. But
and the most unique, you talked about the Greenwood Village blending the two styles. Tell us what we really learned from, we always ask our clients, what is the most challenging project that you've done in the past 12 months?
Most challenging project. Usually the most challenging projects are the ones with the hardest sites to build on. This is a little bit of a cheat answer to your question because we haven't finished designing it yet, but we just kicked off a new project in Boulder. And there was an old part of Boulder where there was a hospital kind of underneath the Sanitas Mountains up on 4th Street, or maybe at 6th Street, I forget. But anyway, there's an old part of the town where there's a hospital that had been sold, and they demoed it, and they plotted it up, and they made residences out of it, and everyone's up there in our competition. So Surround did a house, and Arc 11 did a house. Everyone's doing a house. And one that we have is kind of the leftover site up there, and there's some really strong parameters around zoning where we can't really do as high as we want to do comfortably, and the setbacks are pretty stringent, and the bulk plane in Boulder, we have this rule called a solar access, where you basically promise to give your client and then their neighbors access to solar power if they choose to harvest it in whatever way they want to harvest it. So it ends up being more stringent.
Challenge, yeah.
Yeah, it's more stringent than the bulk paint. It basically tells you where you can cast a shadow. But this is all to say that that site is really difficult to work on. I mean, it's very challenging. But you know what's interesting is in our office, and this is, I assume this is the same in other offices, but it, we get excited about it because we like really have to rack our brains and we all kind of bond over how hard it is to figure it out, you know? And so I think our best projects come out of those challenges.
Heck yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah. So if there's one thing you're going to leave behind and for contractors and architects listening to this to take to the bank, what's the one thing that you would say that you've learned that you want the whole world to hear in the art of construction?
My 5-minute speech to change the world? I don't know. That's a good question. We'll probably change every 2 or 3 months, right? Because this is how we work. But I went to a conference recently and an architect was talking about the process and getting something built and this amazing design. This is a really well-known international architect. And he said something that I think we all agreed with and we're kind of shocked
by.
Who
was that?
Oh, it was Rick Joy, the architect Rick Joy. He spoke at the AIA Colorado conference. It was in Copper Mountain this year.
Yeah.
He said, when you find a contractor that appreciates design, you keep that contractor. And we're like, oh yeah, that's actually important. So I appreciate design because, and by appreciate, I mean values and I mean prioritizes too, because when you think about the incentives that everyone has on a project, design is not always the highest incentive for a contractor. And that's not because they don't care about design. It's just because their incentives lie in different fields. And so when you get a contractor that has the awareness or the personal values to really appreciate design and loves design themselves, you keep that contractor.
And the best outcomes in construction typically come from the best collaboration. And that's, you know, easier said than done, but it really is important when you get somebody that's working well. It's a, you talked about communication and that importance of bringing it together. Mm-hmm. That's when you get a great project and everybody wins.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we're working with Old Greenwich Builders right now on a few.
It's funny. I was going to say their name. A builder that Chris and Kress and the team are all about.
Absolutely.
That thing.
And I haven't worked with everyone at Old Greenwich, but Kress especially, and then one of their supers who's taking on other roles in the office, Matt Archer, especially. I'm working on a house with them at Sloan's Lake, and the amount of innovation that they come to the table with is really impressive.
So globally, they're a builder here. You know, HMH is a great architect firm, and Old Greenwich Builders has just blown up to like 15-plus project managers. So a lot of the architect firms are working with them, mm-hmm. but they really understand what that architect said about finding a, you know, taking a contractor that really understands and goes after the design. And we're always talking about at Mountain View is getting spec to secure the vision and understand the value and all of us working together to make it happen instead of cut corners.
Yeah, actually the Greenwood Village project I worked with Brett on pretty closely, and you know, he brought ideas and solutions that I hadn't thought about to the table. And so you know, when we talk about what window we want to use and what manufacturer we want to use, a lot of times we're like, well, can we get Brett to work on it? You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, totally.
Yeah, he's a big fan of you guys, and I'm a big fan of him to him and the team.
Yeah, he saved my butt a few times, so I owe him a beer or something.
Oh, that's awesome.
Tell us a book or a resource that you're using that you found that's very helpful.
It's probably isn't what you're expecting. I just borrowed a book from a peer of mine at CU on hand sketching, how to be better at hand sketching.
Okay.
And it goes back to that communication piece.
And what's that book?
I won't be able to tell you, but I could probably email it to you.
Okay.
if you put it in
the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and this book specifically was about how to teach people to draw, and it took a little slightly different approach, and I think it was pretty effective. So I was looking at it for the intent of teaching students at a recruitment event for CU about how to draw and give them kind of a sample lecture as if you come here, this is what you can expect from your professors type of thing. But I got a lot out of it, and it occurred to me that the ways in which I've been drawing and keeping my skills fresh aren't really geared towards the communication of how I'm thinking and how I'm designing. They're really more geared towards beautiful things and objects.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of gut check and be like, oh, I'm telling my students that it's not important to draw things that are beautiful necessarily, just things that communicate their intent. And here I'm not even walking my own talk. So it's one of the cool things about teaching is I have to gut check myself from time to time.
Yeah. So who do you think would be a good guest for us to interview on the Art of Construction?
You know, there's an associate. Actually, I think he's a director now or an associate director at SOM. And he's friends of Jayshree and I, too. So you could probably get him. Okay. His name is Lucas Trigestad. And Lucas was a mentor of mine and one of these rare people. He was a middle manager at the time. And now I think he's getting higher up in the firm. But he really cared about the young people on his team and getting them exposure to things and really kind of helping them thrive in an environment that can be a really tough environment to work in. SOM is a very, very serious architecture firm, right? And and so having someone to kind of help focus or lens things through is really nice. Yeah, I think he'd be great for it, actually. And he designs tall buildings, and he's exciting to talk to. So
Cool.
Well, hopefully we can get him onto the Art of Construction. And thanks for taking the time and coming down to Boulder into Denver here and telling us your story. And I really enjoyed hearing your perceptions on everything. And keep up all the good work that you're doing with HMH.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. It was a pleasure to be here.
What a breath of fresh air to hear his story and how his story ties into our field where we're all trying to understand and learn together. I think he really painted a cool picture for me as I was listening to him talk.
No, absolutely. And it's amazing when you think about the details of how much goes into building something that it's not as simple as one might think on the one hand. And on the other hand, there is a lot of passion, a lot of fun, and a lot of work to be done to come up with a great outcome for our customers.
I hear a lot of that right now to where a builder would be like, I'm building these plans, but I've never built a modern house. And when you hear that, it's kind of like time out and make sure you understand when you've been doing those Tuscan homes or something that has this big trim and stuff. It's very different when you're building a modern home where everything has to match in perfectly and have all those perfect angles all architecturally correct.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to think about how simple can actually be more complicated in terms of the execution. So that, like he described, if you're off in the window design by 3/4 of an inch, you might be needing new windows. You might miss.
Also understanding products that fit the modern design really well. So, for example, we talked a little bit about windows and doors, and he talked about, you know, Fleetwood, Rainier, and Anderson, and a few brands. Specifically within the Anderson family of brands, the Anderson E-Series, I love that window system because it has that receiver groove that we have all these metals that we can take those customized metals to make it look and all blend together, but there is some fudge factor in the field where a lot of windows, you don't have that. So I love working with materials that are designed and relevant to the modern industry and understanding that you might want to do things a little bit different when you want that glass house, but you got to bury the structure and put it somewhere.
Well, and the idea of collaboration, communication between the ultimate end user, the architect, the builder, and the suppliers all together can create a great result if you start early and do it often.
And that's what HMH has definitely done, from doing lunch and learns with us, going on Anderson flybacks, really getting educated, and then we truly all work together to collaborate and spec to secure our vision. So thanks to Neil for taking the time, and a great architect firm. If you're looking to build in Colorado, I would definitely interview HMH Architecture Plus Interiors out of Boulder, Colorado. Principals Harvey and Sherry run a great operation. It's fun to see Neil come in and tell their story of where he's been, but how proud he is of the HMH family.
Absolutely.
Thanks for another great show. I challenge you to go check out the show notes. There's a message board there to reach out to us. And if you have someone else that you think would be a great listen, thanks for listening, you and all the others out there, as we grow this show and educate the industry. To you, contractors and architects, to grow your business.
You have been listening to The Art of Construction, specifically designed for contractors and architects to help grow your business. To listen to more, please go to www.mtnview.us and click on the podcast tab. Don't forget to like us on Facebook, and thanks for listening.